Florida's race for governor is on. Opa-locka finds itself under investigation, and Craig Pittman shares weird Florida stories. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Governor DeSantis is officially running to keep his post in Tallahassee. He has an advantage, more money. Plus, the Republican voter registration numbers are growing. So, which way is Florida heading in 2022? Also, Opa-locka already faced a federal investigation for corruption. With the sudden resignation of the mayor, the state is once again looking into the municipality's troubles. And finally, people love making jokes about Florida, and sometimes those jokes are warranted. But if you really want to know what the Sunshine State is about, you need to hear it from author Craig Pittman. And we're going to. All of that today on Sundial After the News. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Governor Ron DeSantis continues his fight against COVID mandates. Today, lawmakers are meeting for a special session that the governor called to discuss a handful of bills dealing with vaccine and mask mandates. The governor has rallied against these restrictions since early on in the pandemic, following in the footsteps of former President Donald Trump. With time, it'll become clear whether his take on COVID will help or hurt him in his reelection bid. Politico Florida's Bureau Chief Matt Dixon is joining us to talk about the race, already heating up with a lot of money drama, and we'll be talking about that special session. Matt, let's look at the governor. Officially, he filed his paperwork for reelection, I think it was last week, very quiet about it. Is he in full campaign mode, or because he's the governor, his campaigning is going to be a little different than his opponents for now?
Well, he's sort of been in full campaign mode for a while, and kind of what the official filing means is really just a signal that things are about to ramp up. But it's important context to kind of keep in mind is the governor, like a lot of other politicians, have separate political committees, which they can raise money into whether they're declared candidates or not. And Governor DeSantis has raised almost $55 million just this calendar year since January. So he's been very much politically active. Now just formally filing things means that, you know, is a signal that things are going to start to speed up as far as him hiring campaign staff, maybe more actively messaging. But there's been a behind-the-scenes political churn with the governor for quite some time.
And, you know, that money, just curious, is it all for next year's election? Because, I mean, he hasn't said it, but there's a lot of talk of him running in 24 for president.
Yeah, I don't think it's a terribly well-kept secret among folks who follow Florida politics that the governor is at least on the short list for considering 2024, but more than likely his reelection, even though he is the favorite at this point, and I would think, you know, fairly handily so, it's going to be $100+ million raise. That's just what it costs to run for governor in Florida. So while he's raising a lot of money, probably has his eye towards the White House, whether he wants to say it or not, he's going to need that war chest to return to Tallahassee and serve a second term if he hopes to, you know, hopes to do that.
What do we know about Florida voters and what they feel right now about him?
Well, it all depends. I mean, Democrats are vocally opposed to him. They are very eager to sort of kneecap his national rise. And Republicans, he has Trump level supports with the Republican base. And by that, I mean, it's not just we support the governor, but it's an intense brand of support that, you know, we rarely see with politicians in the modern age. A lot of politicians struggle to get, you know, to a 50% approval rating, and that's seen as very good within the Republican Party. You know, Governor DeSantis is way above that. He's got an intense support, like we saw with former President Trump.
So right now that we know of, it's three Democratic opponents, and we've spoken to all three on this program. But tell me about who those opponents are and who's his most dangerous opponent.
Yeah, the Democratic primary is former Republican Florida governor and now Democratic Congressman Charlie Crist, the Florida Miami State Senator Annette Tadeo, and current Agriculture Commissioner Nikki Fried, none of which have really caught fire, I think, excited the Democratic base yet. They're very much losing in public polling to this so far and in the money race. the dynamic of the race will change a little bit after the primary. And what I mean is whoever emerges from that, whichever Democrat becomes the nominee, sort of the entire Democratic political ecosystem, you know, even nationally to a degree, will coalesce behind that person. So the money and some of the messaging and those things will take care of themselves. But at that point, DeSantis will probably have a significant advantage. So that's why I'd mentioned that DeSantis is probably the favorite to win re-election. And there's a lot of those factors in place that make me think that.
How are they doing in money, though?
Not great so far. They're part of the issue in the most recent candidate to get in was Senator Annette Tadeo, and that concerned some Democrats because it was taking, you know, traditional money for Democrats that was already split two ways between Kristen Freed and potentially splitting it three ways. So right now they're you know, Ron DeSantis is putting up several million dollars a month in new money that he has raised in his political committee, and those other candidates aren't anywhere near that. They're far less than $1 million each month.
Now, you recently wrote about how the Democratic Governors Association has no plans to give significant financial help to Florida Democrats in this race. I mean, that seems kind of weird.
Yeah, well, for them, it's about reason. Well, I should say they deny that. Our reporting was based on Democrats hearing from them, like, you know, we're not going to give you a lot of help. DGA still says that Florida is a targeted seat, but I think you're going to see far fewer resources here. And for them, it's just the idea of limited resources. Their first role is going to be incumbent protection. So if there's an incumbent Democratic governor in another state, their first job is going to be to protect them. And also, Florida is just a really expensive state. It's got 10 media markets during the middle of an election cycle. The Miami, Tampa, and Orlando media markets are amongst the most expensive in the country and anywhere in the country. So they're just kind of looking at the investment they would have to put into Florida versus a really strong incumbent and saying, hey, you know, maybe we can use that money to protect or help elect Democratic governors in cheaper states that we have a better path forward.
So, I mean, what does that mean for how Democrats are treating the state of Florida? Is it because it's too expensive? They're going to just ignore it?
I think ignore is a little strong, but with the past decade, it's not even the past few election cycles anymore. The state has been on kind of a march to the right. It's definitely a center right state at this point. And because it's so expensive and the trend lines are headed in one direction and nationally with President Biden's approval ratings at the moment, you know, there's a lot of time, but at the moment they're not very high. That generally doesn't bode well for, you know, for Democrats having an unpopular Democratic president in the White House. So that can make a tough election cycle for them, you know, more broadly.
But you think about the last gubernatorial election, it was really, really close.
Yeah, no, it was. And we Florida has a history of those going back to past 2010. There was Governor Rick Scott won his first election here a long time ago. It was 1 point. There seems to be an emerging trend in the state where Democrats can get really close but lose by a point or two. And, you know, organizations like the Democratic Governors Association have to make a decision. Is 6 to 10 or $12 million to try to get over that 1 point threshold worth it? And I think that's the conversation they're having right now.
And I mean, again, according to your reporting, that the Democratic Governors Association had spent $15 million in Florida over the last two, gubernatorial election cycles. That doesn't seem like a lot.
Yeah, well, it's a drop in the bucket, I suppose, when you consider all of the donors. But $7 million in an election cycle is a significant chunk of money. And if none of that materializes this election cycle, it would be a significant setback.
Again, I'm talking with Politico Florida's Bureau Chief Matt Dixon. We're talking about the state's gubernatorial race. It's still a year away, but the fight to become Florida's next governor already heating up. Again, three Democrats running against the governor. He has officially put his name in the hat. It was a couple weeks ago. No surprise there. And right now he is building up his war chest, leading in money. And we've seen also, just to mention, that the voter registration numbers, Republicans making a big move over these last 6 months. You can find out more of his reporting, by the way, on our social media, WLRN Sundial. So, Matt, we know that Democrats, in talking about voter registration, they haven't really delivered much on those numbers. What are we looking at right now? Because Republicans have made big strides in this.
Yeah, to put it into context, back in 2008, when President Barack Obama won the state, there was roughly 700,000 more registered Democrats in Florida than there were Republicans. Republicans just recently claimed that they have overtaken them, which is the product of several years of sort of eroding those large Democratic leads, which it really kind of can't be overstated how important that is. Republicans have been winning elections in Florida for a long time, even though there's been more registered Democrats. So now that they have the lead, it's just kind of seen as an additional hurdle for Democrats in a state where they haven't had a ton of luck recently. So it's a real problem. And the Florida Democratic Party has said they in September that they have started amped up their voter registration program, their statewide one headed into 2022. But thus far, as best we can tell, and there's a bit of a lag in the reporting, as best we can tell, Republicans continue to make gains.
I mean, just listening to all this and from what I've read, I get the feeling, is Florida still going to be a battleground state in 24?
Yeah, I think it is, just for the sense that I think it's going to remain. Democrats seem to be able to win the White House now without Florida, but Republicans can't. And because the nature of the state is still always going to be within 1 or 2 points, I think it's always going to get attention. But without question, I think its place on the national map, its place, its role in national politics has been diminished over the past several election cycles, as people nationally, be it talking head types or donors, sort of view it as a more of a center-right state that is an uphill climb for Democrats.
And look, it's Florida. It's so much history, lots of electoral votes, and so much history.
Right.
Let's move over to what's going on in Tallahassee, because lawmakers are up there now for the special session. This is the one that the governor called for, and it's about the COVID mandates. What are some of the things that they're pushing right now?
Well, there's a legislative package that Governor DeSantis wanted, and he's framed it around sort of protecting the rights of workers who don't want to get the vaccine. There's legislation that would create a series of exemptions based on religious status and a few other things that would make it easier for folks to keep their job, who don't want to get vaccinated. There's another bill that would remove, there's currently in law, the Florida Surgeon General, during a state of emergency, a health emergency, can mandate vaccines. It's never been used in the state, but there's a law that would remove, or there's a legislation that would remove that from the books. And then a third bill, they want to, the legislative Republican leaders want to pull Florida out of OSHA, sort of the Federal Workplace Safety Administration, and craft sort of a Florida-specific plan. So that is also on the agenda as well. So and those bills are likely going to pass. Sort of the first rule of a special legislative session is you don't call one unless you have the votes. And I'm in the state capitol right now, and there's very much a sense that these bills are going to pass fairly overwhelmingly with Republican support, and probably be, to the governor by the end of the week.
And I mean, if they pass, would they either likely face lawsuits, and or how would they fare against any federal policy?
Nearly everything that passes the legislature in the past few years has faced the potential for lawsuits. So I can't totally game that out, because I don't know what organizations would necessarily come out of the woodworks to challenge them legally. But I think it's safe to bet almost any high-profile bill at least has a likelihood of ending up in court. We've seen that more and more over the past few years. And as far as clashing with federal policy, they don't directly. The state and specifically Governor DeSantis and the Biden administration have been sort of in a messaging and a more of a political battle than anything else. And DeSantis wants to frame it as worker protection. Of course, Democrats and the Biden administration has implied it's sort of purely political. And that's being waged on more of a messaging front than a policy front.
Because I think about it, if I'm a business owner, am I following the state law or am I following the federal law when it comes to COVID mandates?
Yeah, nothing in this legislative package would directly set up that contradiction. Like I said, it's more of DeSantis trying to pass legislation that, kind of messaging is protecting workers against the Biden administration. But there isn't anything that would be in direct conflict with what they're doing here. A lot of that is kind of turning into more political theater than legislative language.
All right, I got to ask you, because we're talking later with someone who loves to write books about Florida, Craig Pittman, but you're working on a book about Florida's role in national politics. You're going to focus on 2022, then of course 24. what can we look forward to?
Yeah, well, it started out as Florida's role sort of nationally, and it's still focused on that, but it's going to have a lot of themes of what we talked about here, of sort of the process of how Florida has sort of gone from the preeminent swing state to sort of center-right, and the Trump effect that's had on that, and some of the DeSantis and Rick Scott and Marco Rubio jockeying for 2024. So can all expect to have, you know, all of those sort of themes captured in the book, and I'm working on it now, and it's been a lot of fun.
You know, I mean, I think about coming back to what you said about this session, and you sort of touched on it there, but is it really about trying to, you know, to pass any bills, or is it more just about jockeying for position, for political points?
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of the overwhelming theme of the past few years. The state capitol, you know, this will be my 12th or 13th session, has increasingly sort of become a place to advocate for legislation that, you know, you intend to use on the campaign trail. So I think without question, there's a sense of political theater here, but that's not necessarily new, but it has been intensifying in recent years.
So a little more politics and policy, and of course it'll be in your book, so we'll just look forward to that. I want to thank Politico Florida's Bureau Chief Matt Dixon, and you can follow more of his reporting on this on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Matt, always a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
All right, well, coming up, because I just mentioned it, coming up in about 10 minutes, we're going to have that conversation with author Craig Pittman about just how strange it is to live in the state of Florida, but we still love it anyway, right? But first, corruption claims come up again. What's going on in Opa-locka City Hall? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the city of Opa-locka once again finds itself tied up in controversy. Last week, the mayor, Matthew Pigott, up and quit in the middle of a commission meeting. Pigott ran for the office in 2018, saying that he wanted to take the helm of his hometown that has struggled with state oversight, financial challenges, and mismanagement. He wanted to fix it. But he cited the same reasons last week during a commission meeting where he announced his departure. He said, quote, "I will not be a figurehead for corruption." Well, joining us now to break down what happened and what fallout comes next, Samantha Gross of the Miami Herald, who's been covering the story. Samantha, thank you so much for the time. Are we any closer to understanding why Mr. Pigott resigned last week? I mean, he cited corruption, but did he explain anything else?
It's a great question. We are still trying to kind of figure out, you know, what exactly he meant when he was citing corruption in that kind of surprising resignation speech last Wednesday night. So like you said, you know, he's leaving his office 1 year before his term ends, citing corruption and making a lot of other allegations too that he didn't quite elaborate on. So, you know, it's still unclear what kind of allegations he was making, but it's being investigated now. And I'm sure, you know, a lot of those answers are going to start to come out. He has kind of declined to talk further on this.
Who takes over now? Who fills in as mayor?
Yeah, so that's going to be Vice Mayor Veronica Williams. She, you know, in the charter, it's laid out that the vice mayor becomes the interim mayor. And she wrote on Facebook the day after Pigott had resigned, saying that she's going to ensure there's transparency in government will be her goal during this kind of interim period.
So Opa-locka, I mean, we've reported on this as you have for years now, has a reputation for mismanagement, financial turmoil. I mean, when did all of that really start? It kind of goes back a ways.
It does. Yeah, it goes back, you know, almost like 20 years. In the early 2000s, there were kind of allegations of corruption, and the state had first declared a financial emergency when the city was kind of being threatened by bankruptcy. And, you know, fast forward a little bit to 2016, the FBI raided City Hall and a lot of former city employees were arrested on bribery charges. And it was kind of, you know, unveiled that there were insider deals happening and contract schemes and elected officials soliciting bribes from contractors and all of these things. And, you know, Opa-locka is one of the county's poorest cities and kind of fallen into a state after, you know, struggling through the financial crisis and owing millions, you know, to the county for water and sewer and other fees. And, you know, all these things really affected the people who live there. And there's, you know, there's this history there of mismanagement.
But it seems like at least for a little while now, things have been quiet. I don't know if that necessarily correlates to things have been good, but they've just been quiet. I mean, is that the case? Because this departure is pretty significant.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, since the 2016 raid and those arrests, things have kind of quieted down. And in his speech, Paget had kind of, touted some accomplishments that the city's made. They've made some, they've replaced the faulty water meters and they've submitted some overdue financial audits and the 5-year recovery plan to the state that they were supposed to have submitted. And they've paved some streets and they've fixed potholes. And they, you kind of talked about that. But, his resignation speech that kind of made all of these broad allegations maybe hint at some other things that have been going on behind the scenes, but the details of which are still kind of unknown.
By the way, Opa-locka's government, city government, it's still under control of the state oversight board, right?
Correct. So yeah, in 2016, after all of that went down, then Governor Rick Scott, now Senator, declared a financial emergency for the city. And so he set up an oversight board to basically oversee the budget, every spend that they make, really keeping a close eye on the city. And they've remained under control of the state oversight ever since. Recently in 2019, there was a report that cited 99 issues of fraud and mismanagement. So they're still working to get out of that financial emergency state. So they are still under watch, from at the state level.
And wondering too, because again, the FBI was involved before. Has that all been resolved? Their investigation? Has anything else come of that?
Well, now, they're still looking the state from at the state level. Like the state's auditor general is due to complete a report in 2022, and as you saw, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement is kind of taking a new look. So I think that there will probably be more to come, once we know a little bit more about what exactly they're investigating. But there's certainly a lot of question marks there at the city level right now.
So what happened to Pigott? I mean, did he disappear? Have you heard from him? Have you spoken to him?
I have, yeah. So we communicated briefly about 2 days after the resignation. And he had confirmed to me that he had met with state police about a month ago and otherwise declined to comment on what he had told them. But he told me, he's taking some overdue time for his family, and when he's ready, he will reach out. So that's all I've heard from him. It's been, pretty quiet on his end. He did post a transcript of his resignation speech on a personal website that he made. And he directed me there. But yeah, I think, there's still obviously a lot of questions about what he's doing now, why he decided to do this, what the details of those allegations were. But I'm sure there's going to be more to come soon, and we're keeping a close eye on it.
Have we heard from Governor DeSantis's office what they have to say about what's happening?
They did not respond to my request for comment, but the state senator Dennis Baxley co-chairs a committee in the Florida legislature to investigate these types of things. It's a joint committee between the Senate and the House. And he said, last year they voted to have the auditor general go back to Opa-locka and come back with a report. This year that committee is going to convene again. And I was told that, the state of Opa-locka, the state of things in Opa-locka will be top of mind. So, and he talked about some of the findings that that committee had, been reviewing the last year.
What have you heard from other city officials or even anybody in the city of Opa-locka? I mean, after again, the mayor in the middle of a meeting says, "I'm out. That's it. I'm done," and brings up the word corruption again. I mean, what have people been saying about that?
Yeah, I mean, the former officials that I talked to were kind of stunned by it. For now, the current officials are keeping pretty mum. But I did talk to the city manager, who has kind of a history with the mayor. They don't get along at all. And he, didn't want to comment on the allegations that were made. But he told me that the city's going to continue to move forward and it's going to operate. And there is, a quorum on the commission, so they are able to meet. If he wants to call a meeting for city manager business, he can. And as I said, the vice mayor is kind of taking in that interim place, and I think it's left to be seen kind of what happens next. But at least from the city manager's perspective, the operations of the city are going to continue forward as they were.
This is just one of those stories. Opa-locka is a fascinating place, but it's just again because, as you said, over years, so many stories have come out of there, and it's just for a small little town, so much news. By the way, just coming back to the FDLE investigation, do we know anything about that yet? What did you tell me again about what they're looking into?
Yeah, so they can't talk about the nature of the investigation, but they did confirm that there's an active and ongoing investigation. You know, it's pretty common in the early stages of an FDLE investigation. They're not going to talk about any details. But you know, we do know from them and you know from the mayor himself or the former mayor himself that he had contacted state police. So that's also left to be seen. A lot of question marks here, but we do know that they are looking at the city and hopefully we'll know more soon.
A lot of question marks, but we'll keep up on this story as you are. Samantha Gross of the Miami Herald. Follow her reporting on this on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Samantha, always a pleasure. Thank you for the insight.
Thanks for having me.
And I just want to remind everyone that we'd love you to keep in touch with us. We want to hear your thoughts about the program, anything that you hear on the show. And listen, maybe you live in Opa-locka and you've got something to say about what's happening with your city government. We'd love to hear from you. The easiest way to do it is through the Sundial Text Club. You can join the text club. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. And when you do, you can always reach us that way anytime throughout the day, throughout the week. Let us know about any segment that you've heard, or maybe you have an idea for a story we should be covering. Well, still to come, Florida's own Mark Twain. Author Craig Pittman talks to us about what inspired his newest book. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. You know, when you think about it, Florida, I think, has a little bit of everything, right? From the politicians to the criminals to the wildlife, the tourists, the residents, all of our quirky laws. The Sunshine State is never a boring place. And the person who's written about all the weirdness and eccentricities of this state better than anyone, I think, is Craig Pittman. And by the way, his latest book is The State You're In, Florida Men, Florida Women, and Other Wildlife. He is going to be at this year's Miami Book Fair. He's actually there tomorrow, and we've got all the details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Craig, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Craig, I'm going to put you on the hot seat to start. I want to ask you, what's one thing you hate about Florida?
One thing I hate about Florida.
Yes. And I know there's got to be something.
Oh, gosh. Probably that fall only lasts about 30 minutes. I think that's sort of the one thing I wish it lasted a little bit longer.
We had this.
The weather is so lovely when it's like that.
We had this conversation today. Does Florida have seasons?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We have snowbird season. We have fix the road season. We have hurricane season, of course. You know, that's also known as, oh, my God, it's so hot. Oh, my God, it's so hot. Oh, no, here comes a storm. In Florida, they say that you can tell it's fall when the license plates change color. So, you know, as the snowbirds all come back. That's what you look for.
You've made it official for all of us. You said it. That's how it is. Absolutely. Is there any place in the state you have not visited?
Oh, there are lots of places. And I detail some of that in the book. I have a Florida bucket list. I would love to go camping in the Dry Tortugas. I've never been. I think that would be a wonderful experience. I have never, believe it or not, I've never been to the Devil's Mill Hopper in Gainesville. I would love to go see that. I did manage to check off a few things, though. I went and saw a ghost orchid in the Corkscrew Swamp Sanctuary. They actually, you can see it from the boardwalk there, as long as you bring some binoculars or something like that. I went to the Swamp Ape, quote-unquote, research headquarters, where they can establish the existence of the skunk ape through blurry photos and souvenir T-shirts. And... and I went to Florida Southern, where they have the largest number of Frank Lloyd Wright buildings all together in one spot in the whole world.
Do you have a favorite spot in Florida?
Well, I really like Myakka River State Park. I really like Sanibel Island. That's a great place to go pick up seashells. You know, any of the Florida state parks are great to visit wherever you are. They've actually won awards four times which, you know, no other state park system has done that, in spite of, or perhaps because of the fact that Florida State Park System is the only governmental agency in the nation that employs mermaids. So, you know, that's a weeky-watchy spring state park where, you know, it was a classic Florida roadside attraction dating back to the 40s. And then when it got into financial trouble in the mid-2000s, rather than see the spring bought by a water bottler or developer, state stepped in and bought it and turned it into a state park. So now the mermaids work for us taxpayers, which has led to some interesting conversations about the use of tax dollars to pay for waterproof lipstick and shell bras.
I think it's worth paying for mermaids. I think so, but that's fine. You know, going through this book, what I love about it is you put together all these stories, and look, some of them are funny and absurd because we're Florida, but there's a good mix of tales of really interesting people, and I think a little more serious side of Florida. I mean, you do that on purpose?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you can't, it's not all funny. You know, it's not all fun and games here in Florida. So there's some real serious stuff that goes on here. You know, so there's a big long piece in there about what it's like to live on death row. This guy who was there for years and years and years after he was sentenced to die. And on the flip side, there's a story about a woman who spent years going to the parole hearings to keep her father's killers locked up inside. You know, there are some serious pieces about animals too. There's a piece reporting from the first day of the first Florida bear hunt in 21 years, which ended the very next day, and they haven't had another one since then. There are serious things that happen here in Florida, and I think we should, you know, keep an eye out for them. But you know, sometimes tragedy wears the mask of comedy in Florida also. And so you just have to kind of be aware of that.
Again, talking with Florida author Craig Pittman. His latest book is called The State You're In, Florida Men, Florida Women, and Other Wildlife. He's going to be presenting at this year's Miami Book Fair, and the live stream event is tomorrow, and you can learn all about it, know all about it, if you want to watch it, on our social media at WLRN Sundial, also on our website at WLRN.org. You know, because I was thinking about that, Craig, is like, look, Florida's the butt of so many jokes. And I've lived out of the state, and I remember even hearing all the jokes about Florida. So it is real, like everywhere. They love to make fun of us. But when you're telling the stories about Florida, is there that concern, like, it can't all be goofy because, you know, we don't want Florida to be a joke all the time, right?
Well, sure. And I argued in my previous book, Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country, that if you think of Florida only as the punchline state, then you're missing out, because an awful lot of stuff happens here that's really serious, a lot of stuff that actually influences the rest of the country. And people don't even realize that these things go on or these things have happened that, you know, that affect their lives. I contend, you know, we are supposedly the sunshine state, even though we're actually rainier than Seattle. But I contend we should change our nickname to the most interesting state, because I think we can back that one up pretty easily.
as like I said, everything happens here. Everything.
Yes.
I don't think there's anything that hasn't.
No.
You break up the book.
And in fact, if you know, whenever there's a viral news story, I have friends who say, please don't be Florida. Please don't be Florida. But there's always a Florida angle. Remember the woman, I think like last year or year before, who got in trouble for trying to bring her emotional support peacock on board a plane in New Jersey?
Yes.
The peacock was from Miami.
Of course it was. Of course it was. Oh, I love how you break this up into sections. We look at some of the unique men and women of the state. Obviously, we look at crime. You look at the environment. And then, of course, some of the quirkier stories, some of the serious ones as well. I wanted to start by asking you about Jack Rudlow. This sounded like a really interesting story. I think this is the real true Florida man.
Yeah, well, you know, Jack would probably agree with you. he's this guy. He was not a college graduate or anything, but he has a strong interest in biology, and he started his own marine supply business up in the Panhandle, up in this town called Panacea, and it's still going strong, you know, this many decades later. And Jack is still irritating the powers that be every time he shows up at a government meeting, and actually got yanked out of one of them by sheriff's deputies. And he has managed to keep it going in spite of the pandemic. You know, he was always welcoming to school groups coming in to see his touch tanks and, you know, commune with all the various sea creatures. And then suddenly the pandemic hit and the tours stopped, but they have managed to keep going somehow. And it's still out there and it's still going. And Jack is Jack. What can I say? But he's also written some fascinating books. The Forgotten Coast is one. The Living Dock is another one. My mom was a big fan of his books. She never told me about The Erotic Ocean. Somehow she neglected to mention that.
I wonder why. You know what? I mean, because he was like, Florida for so long until, you know, before we had like Disney and, you know, the big theme parks, you know, Florida was the side road, the attractions that you would find, yes, on the side of the road. You'd have to travel the highways and you'd see all these interesting little things. He was that guy for a long time.
Yeah, it was sort of a sideshow. You know, that's what Florida had. You know, we would try and pull the tourists in and then give them interesting stuff to look at even before the theme parks. And one of those places you would go would be Jack's place up in Panacea. Now, Panacea is kind of off the beaten path. The school groups that are coming through are going to Tallahassee or coming back from there and stopping in. But he had this marine supply business, sort of like one of the characters in John Steinbeck's book, Cannery Row. But he set up an aquarium so that people could come by and actually see the things that he was finding there. And it was always really fascinating stuff.
Did that, by the way, did his place survive the pandemic?
Yeah, it's still around. He's still posting things on Facebook. There are live videos of sea turtles and so forth that they find. And it's managing to keep going somehow.
I love also you write about some of the writers, Florida, yes, writers. And
this book is sort of a love letter to Florida storytellers, particularly that last piece.
Is there, who would you say, I mean, take you aside because you are one of them, I believe, but who do you think is one of the best when it comes to writing, especially fiction, based out of Florida?
Well, I mean, there's a long piece in there about Charles Williford, who who's sort of the godfather of wacky Florida, South Florida crime novels. And his book, Miami Blues, really, I think, captures Miami in the 1980s. It's really sort of a character in the book. And his stuff is really enjoyable, although he once said, if you write this truth, people will accuse you of using black humor. and there's I'm a big fan, and there's a piece in there about John D. McDonald. A lot of people know him from his Travis McGee mysteries, where he had this boat bum who lived aboard the busted flush at slip F-81 in Fort Lauderdale. But he wrote an awful lot of other books as well, and a lot of them were set in Florida and used them to sort of slip in environmental themes that most people don't even realize, when they're reading them, they don't quite catch that they're getting indoctrinated in this stuff. He was warning us about all the shady people trying to pave over the state. His masterpiece, I think, is Condominium, and that's actually the book that's on the cover of my book. That's the book I'm holding, as I'm assuming the Statue of Liberty pose there.
You mentioned Charles Williford, and we had highlighted his book Miami Blues on the Sundial Book Club a couple of years ago, and I had the wonderful opportunity of speaking with his widow. And, she told me so many wonderful stories about him. You know what, though? She didn't tell me. You pointed it out in your book, but she didn't tell me the story. Like, he had a reader send back.
Side swipe. Yes.
Send back. It would tell the story. This is great. I love this.
He wrote a sequel to Miami Blues called Side Swipe. And apparently one of the readers did not enjoy it the way he was supposed to and put it in a package, sent it back to Williford, who opened the package. And inside was a note written in all caps saying it's a crime to charge this much money for crap like this. And then there was a copy of the book that had six bullet holes through it. and his friends were all horrified. They're like, oh my God, you need to call the FBI. You need to call the police and warn them about this. And he said, no, it's good to get feedback.
Oh, I wonder how would I feel if a reader sent back my book with bullet holes in it. All right.
I like feedback, but I don't think I want any feedback like that.
I don't know, man. Well, for you, I'd imagine somebody sends like an iguana with a book or maybe a python wrapped around
it.
But
the origin of this book is when Oh Florida came out and was a big bestseller, two things happened. One was when I went around promoting the book, people would come up and tell me their Florida stories. My favorite one, by the way, was the couple who discovered their next door neighbor was running an illegal nudist bed and breakfast. And the way they found that out was they gave their kids a trampoline for Christmas.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so then the second thing that happened was people kept coming up and saying, when are you going to write a sequel? We want a sequel. Why is there no sequel to Oh, Florida? Where is, you know, Oh, Florida 2 Electric Boogaloo? And I kept saying, well, I kind of said all I want to say. It's all in there, you know. But I thought about it. And the more I thought, well, maybe there's a way to do a, not necessarily a sequel, but a sort of a son of Oh, Florida that celebrates that spirit of glorious weirdness in Florida.
You know what,
so
Craig?
That's where this book came from.
Craig, give it a few more years and you'll have more material. Don't worry. Just give it time. There'll be more material. We're talking with Craig Pittman. Again, he's going to be presenting at this year's Miami Book Fair. Actually, the event is live streamed tomorrow. And you can find out more on our website, WLRN.org. His newest book is The State You're In, Florida Men, Florida Women, and Other Wildlife. I want to talk about the wildlife. This is my this is my favorite section because you cover everything. We got iguanas, sea cucumbers. I didn't even know there was a thing called the leopard eel, but you taught me that. Thank you.
That's my favorite story in that section.
That's so strange, and it was like by accident that we found it.
Yeah, there was this legendary creature up in the Panhandle called it the leopard eel. Supposedly, it lurked in the swamps. There was this long, skinny creature with little paddles and spots on its body and little wings on its head, and you know, scientists were like, yeah, sure, right? But then this one scientist actually found one by accident and contacted a friend of his, and together they spent their own time and money and wrote up a scientific description of it, you know, did all the things you're supposed to do. They discovered it's not an eel at all. It's a type of salamander called a siren. So they called it the reticulated siren, and they discovered those wings on its head are actually external gills for breathing underwater. And in the story I wrote about it, I mentioned that when he found that first one, he put it in a bucket of water and then transferred it to a Tupperware container. And so after the story ran, I get this very sternly worded letter from a New York patent attorney saying, I represent Tupperware, and we want to make sure that you are using that term properly in your story, that you weren't just talking about some other brand of resealable plastic container. I said, you know, I wrote him back and I said, I completely understand. You know, Tupperware is a Florida product. You've got this museum in Kissimmee where you can, you know, I guess go around and burp all the historic products. And I would never cast aspersions on a Florida-based product like that. And in fact, I think your clients are missing a bet. I think they need to hire this scientist and pay him to endorse Tupperware and say, if you tell all his fellow scientists, if you find a legendary creature that suddenly turns out to exist, the best place to store them is in Tupperware. Surprisingly, they have not taken me up on that
idea. You know, I think about all of the strange creatures that we're finding, a lot of them invasive, especially some of the bigger, worse ones. I mean, are you worried that they're going to destroy Florida? I mean, like the python.
I think they're making Florida different. I don't know if they're destroying it. And the interesting thing about the pythons is they're actually considered endangered in their home territory over in Thailand. But here they're thriving. So if we wipe them out here, they're going to be completely gone. I don't know. But it's an interesting discussion to have. There's a piece in there where I go along with these two women who they run a dog grooming salon in St. Petersburg during most of the week. And then on the weekends, they grab their camper and go down to the Everglades and hunt pythons. There's also a piece in there, speaking of invasives, about all the iguanas turning up in toilets.
Have you ever had one pop up in your toilet?
I have not had one pop up in my toilet, thank God, but I do know to look before I sit down.
Oh, I'm terrified. Every time I see that story, I freak out. You know what? There's an effort to, there's going to be, they're pushing for an eradication movement in the Keys of iguanas.
Well, good luck with that. What,
do you think that's a good idea?
I find it hard to believe that it will work. Listen, the reason I say that is the first place I ever saw iguanas was on the island of Boca Grande over on the Gulf side of the state. And they were running around like crazy. And Boca Grande actually voted to tax themselves to pay for a trapper to come in and try and trap all the iguanas and remove them. That's been like two decades ago. He's still working. he's still trying to catch all the iguanas.
Wow.
And has actually written a cookbook called Save Florida, Eat an Iguana. which is not a story you would hear from any other state. They have an iguana tax to pay for a trapper who's written a cookbook.
A cookbook on iguanas. Maybe, you know what, somewhere down the road you could have a python cookbook if that ever works out for you.
Pythons actually are, the large ones especially, are full of mercury. So scientists caution you to be careful with those. But there is a python hunter I know who, she has a testing kit and she tests the amount of mercury in the snakes that she catches. And if it's a low amount, then she tries out different recipes with them and posts the videos on Facebook. Her liver and onions is supposed to be really good. And she uses the eggs to make cookies.
I was going to have lunch after this, but
maybe I should write a cookbook next.
There you go. You spent so many years, as an environment reporter, and I don't know if I've ever asked you this question. What do you think? And we just had the big, climate conference, global climate conference in Glasgow. And I wonder, what do you think about all the projections of the climate crisis and sea level rise for the state of Florida? Like, where do you see Florida in like 50 years?
I think somebody's going to make an awful lot of money selling swim fins and snorkels.
You think it's going to be that bad?
And new waterfront property. Well, look at it this way. How many finger canal subdivisions do you know about that are all around the state, particularly in say Fort Lauderdale, in the Keys, Miami, places like that? Those places were built to be about a foot above sea level, and that was before we really knew sea level was rising. So all of those places, like Stillwater Point down in Key Largo, I think, is a good example where the water rose up and stayed up for almost 9 months. People were having to live with water in their streets every single day.
Yeah.
That's going to become much more common, I think, as the water continues rising. And some politicians don't take it seriously, or say, oh, I'm not a scientist. Well, no, but the scientists who are scientists, they can tell you this is something big and we need to do something about it.
Would you ever go anywhere else? Would you ever leave Florida?
Oh, good Lord, no. Why? Why would I leave? I will never run out of Florida stories. Never. I'm just convinced of it. I mean, I'm co-host of a podcast called Welcome to Florida, and we've been going for a year. We haven't repeated ourselves once yet. We've had the python hunter I mentioned who cooks the meat. She's been a guest. We've had a gator wrangler. We've had a nudist, because Florida has more nudist resorts than any other state. We've had a cockroach expert, a shark biologist, because we get more shark bites than anywhere else. I mean, just some fascinating people, and every single one of them, they have a different view of Florida, and it's interesting to talk to them.
What does it mean, because you've now been called Florida's Mark Twain? What does that mean to you?
Well, I guess I need to start smoking cigars, huh?
Grow the mustache, and yeah,
I've got the mustache. Yeah. I got a beard.
No. You have to grow the mustache.
I don't know about that.
Like he had. You're going to be talking at the book fair with Tyler Gillespie. He's got his book, The Thing About Florida: Exploring a Misunderstood State. Are you guys just going to have fun with this, or?
Well, Tyler, like me, is a Florida native, so it's a couple of endangered species getting together there. And Tyler has written some interesting essays about his encounters with things that he's worried about, things that he thinks about Florida, and we have a pretty good conversation. We disagree on some things, we agree on some others. I think it'll be a good chat.
I can't see you anywhere else. You are Florida's man. You are the Florida man, Craig. So just stay here. Actually, I'm going to put a notice to Tallahassee. Let's put you on Florida's flag. How about that?
Oh, you really want to scare people.
There you go.
Actually, you know what would be great is if we returned to the one that flew over the state capitol in 1845 that said, "Let us alone." I think that's the one we might benefit from the most.
With Craig's face, "Let us alone. We are Florida and we're proud of it." Craig Pittman, his latest book, The State You're In, Florida Men, Florida Women, and Other Wildlife, again, presenting at the Miami Book Fair, the live stream tomorrow. Learn more about it on our social media, WLRN Sundial, or on our website, WLRN.org. Craig, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much. The book is so much fun.
Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed it. I hope lots of people go out and buy it.
All right. We'll talk again soon.
Take care.
Well, it's always a pleasure to talk to that guy. It just always is. Well, that's our program for this Monday, November 15th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, artists and musicians have led the opposition movement in Cuba after planned protest led to more government crackdowns on the communist island. We're going to get an update on the latest, and we're going to hear some of the music that's spurred the opposition movement forward. Cuban-American singer-songwriter Lily Blanco will join us to chat about the music coming up from the island and the change that it's building up in the works. Also, later this week, we're going to be looking at the growing rents in South Florida and around the country, and we want to hear from you. Are you out there right now trying to find a place to rent, but you're finding that the prices are just, they're going up too fast, too much and too fast? We want to hear your story. Text us 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. Or you can email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Again, we want to talk about, how are people getting by? And if you're finding yourself renting a place and the rents have gone up a lot, what are you having to give up? What do you have to give up so that you can live where you want to live? Again, email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Well, that's our program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
You see that cat man? His hair was blue down in Florida. We welcome you to the Sunshine State. We're kicking back and soaking up the rays.
WLRN Public Media.